Hey, welcome along. This is Mark Stein with another one of our live Clubland Q&As across the planet. It's 4 p.m. Eastern time in North America. That means it's 5 o'clock in the Canadian Maritimes, 5:30 in Newfoundland, 6 o'clock in Bermuda, and 9 p.m. in Dublin, where the cheers over the Irish abortion referendum have just about died down. 10 o'clock in Western Europe, 11 o'clock the Middle East, midnight in Moscow, 1:30 a.m. in Delhi. And it all gets a bit fuzzy after that, but I think it's 4 a.m. in Honkers and 6 a.m. in Sydney, and an early breakfast for our New Zealand listeners. But if you are in Hong Kong and you've taken the trouble to get up early and listen, do put that in your question when you file it at Stein Online, and I will endeavour to give it priority, as you've done me the honour of getting up so early. If you're in America, by the way, you got nothing else to do. You can't go to Starbucks, because I believe at the top of the hour, or was it the top of the previous hour, they closed for their sensitivity training. So if you've gone into Starbucks and the service seems even slower than usual, it's because they've all gone into the bathroom to hold their sensitivity training session. So they're going to be in there for hours. So give it up. You might as well listen to this. The other big American story is the cancellation of Roseanne. And believe me, I know about cancelled TV shows. And I'm not going to say a word about that, because I think I'm going to be talking about that with Tucker Carlson later tonight on Fox News. So we will leave that issue and talk about some of the other ones. And actually, Carl Lind from La Jolla in California asks about the Irish referendum and says, I found the large public celebration after the vote on abortion disturbing. Do these cheering people not have a clue about the serious issues involved? Yeah, it's interesting to me that, Carl, during the referendum in Ireland on abortion, they all said they weren't going to be triumphalist and celebratory over it. And in the end, they couldn't resist, as well they might, because it was a landslide. It was, 70% in favour of it. And it's astonishing to an Irishman such as myself. I'm flying a few flags of convenience today, but for the purposes of what I'm about to say, I speak as an Irishman. An Irishman who remembers the first time the Angelus played in the pub at 6 o'clock and thought, what's up with that? Ireland, the Angelus for non-Catholics, by the way, is one of those little devotional things that Catholics are prone to, and I believe they still play it before the 6 o'clock. It's like basically like the Muslim call for prayer for Czech Catholics. It's not. I'm just making a joke. Lighten up. They play it at 6 o'clock on the main television network and also on the main radio network in Ireland. Ireland was a seriously Catholic country, and for people who aren't Irish, I will say, I think of all the stories that are around at the moment, the Irish abortion vote is directly relevant to what's happening in Europe, because to me it reminds us of how a population can be transformed in really a very short time. I said, I'm old enough to remember being stunned when they had the Angelus in the pub, but I'm not quite old enough. I'm almost old enough, but not quite, to remember when unionists used to mock Irish home rule as Rome rule. In other words, that once Southern Ireland seceded from the United Kingdom, it would become a priest-ridden backwater. And that's not entirely true, but you could see why unionists would look at it that way. Instead, really, within a remarkably short space of time, Ireland has become just another secular European state. to the point where now it has transformed its constitutional prohibition on abortion. Now, there's always been a bit of humbug about this. They could afford to ban abortion in Ireland because, as anybody who's caught, and this has happened to me over the years, if you ever caught the night boat from Dunleary to Holyhead, you would often find yourself with a chatting with a moon-faced Colleen, who turned out to be enceinte, as they say, who was would emerge somewhere in the course of the voyage that she was going to Wales to get an abortion in Wales. So in a sense, the Ireland's abortion laws were enabled by the fact that you could just hop on the night boat from Dunleary to Holyhead and go and get your abortion in Wales. There's always been an element of humbug about these things. But the fact is that Ireland was, until recently, a seriously Catholic country. And if you look at what's happened with the vote on abortion and the vote on gay marriage, it can no longer be said to be that. It's that the Taoiseach, which is Irish for Prime Minister, the Taoiseach is some gay, childless Hindu. And he seems a perfectly pleasant fellow, as gay, childless Hindus go. But the point I'm making here is that Ireland in 2017 would have been unrecognisable to the guys who fought for Irish independence more or less exactly a century ago. And they wouldn't have seen the point. If you'd said to Eamon de Valera, if you'd said we're going to create an Ireland that's going to be governed by a gay, childless Hindu with legal abortion, he'd have said, what's the point of that? Can you send in a few more black and tans, London? There's no point. There's no point to this kind of Irish independence. So what's gone on here? Well, I think this is what happens when you have a climate, the kind of controlled media climate in which it's taken for granted that issues are framed, the assumptions in which issues are discussed are all those of the left. And that's certainly the case in Ireland, in which I would say, you know, there's double. I would say the Irish press, I would say the Dublin press is not as bad as some on continental Europe, but it operates within a relatively narrow framework. And I think you see the same thing in London, which is why it seems entirely natural for people, again, to accept the way issues are framed within a leftist, broadly speaking, a leftist narrative. And I think one result of that is that it becomes incredibly difficult. It's almost as if for the 70% who voted for abortion, what happens is that those default left-wing framings of the issues, they don't seem like political positions at all, ultimately. They're just the default setting of society. They become as the air that you breathe. And I think that's what happened in Ireland. And I think to a certain extent it explains part of the reaction to Tommy Robinson, Islamization activist who's currently in Her Majesty's prison in Hull in England. Alison Coates writes, can anything be done by us to help get Tommy Robinson out of jail? It would seem that constitutional protections here in the US will keep us from getting to that point. But then there was that fellow jail for making a film that caused the Benghazi riots. And of course, Flynn was railroaded and Mueller's still going. So no, apparently there aren't such protections. Let me just address that, by the way, Alison, before we go any further. I have a preference. I disagree with the Dublin vote. And if I'd been in Dublin, I've just said I'm an Irishman, and if I'd been in, if I'd voted in that referendum, I would have voted against it. But I think it's actually better for a society to at least take responsibility for these acts by voting as citizens for themselves than having five judges torture the plain meaning of the English language to discern a right to gay marriage or abortion in the US Constitution. On the whole, I think it's more honest to say,
Hello there. We used to be against abortion, and we used to be against the godless sodomites, but now we changed our mind, so we're voting for it. Go for it, lads.
I think that's actually more honest than to have five judges attempt to discern emanations from the penumbra and all the rest of it, Alison. What gets how soon Tommy Robinson gets out of jail? This judge devoted 4 minutes to it. And we've had some pushback from people at Stein Online. If you read the comments, there are club members who dislike what I had to say about it and said it's not a four-minute trial. It's that he broke the terms of his conditional sentence, so he was being sent to jail. I've been in a lot of courtrooms. I've been in a lot of American courtrooms. Nothing happens in 4 minutes. Nothing. They move at the speed of molasses, and the only thing that happens is because somebody hasn't shown up or somebody hasn't got this or that bit of paperwork, and they kick the can down the road for another 30 or 60 days. That's how it is in a U.S. courtroom. When they take you from soup to nuts, from walking in the door to being carted off to jail in 4 minutes, that's extremely unusual. In this case, he did not have his own solicitor or barrister, as it were, representing him. That also is not, you know, the right to choose one's own counsel, particularly when you have counsel, is also fundamental to justice. So he was represented by some guy who didn't know him, didn't know the case or whatever. That is also inimical to justice. And having read the original sentence, which I think is frivolous in certain respects, when the judge actually says, as a lady judge, I think it's Judge Norton, if I recall, and she refers to the fact, this is a guy, it's been documented that he was savagely assaulted while he was detained at Her Majesty's pleasure, as they say in jails in England. He was detained at Her Majesty's pleasure, and Her Majesty couldn't even prevent him being savagely assaulted in prison. So when Judge Norton actually said, they say he's at risk of being beaten up in prison, and my, you know, my initial reaction to that is, quote, so what? Question mark, unquote. That's a quote from her actual sentencing remarks. I don't like her insouciance about that, because I think when the state incarcerates someone, it has the responsibility to ensure that that person remains safe. Just as I don't like it when an attorney general in California a couple of years ago was making jokes about having the head honcho at Enron, Ken Lay, I believe it was, showing him into a jail cell with, here's your roommate, Butch. So basically, you know, the Attorney General of California is making jokes about incarcerating prisoners with guys who are going to rape them and give them AIDS. I don't think that's appropriate, and I don't think it's appropriate for Judge Norton at Canterbury Crown Court to be quite so insouciant about Tommy Robinson being beaten up in prison. But at least she noted the fact. The guy in Leeds didn't. This does not pass the smell test. It is not appropriate. It is not seemly. And the idea that a guy can simply be seized, the concerns that Judge Norton at least noted in that order disregarded, and he winds up in HMP Hull, I think is fairly disgraceful. Robert Stewart writes, Mark, there is no evidence that an anti-Muslim hysteria is sweeping any Western country. But the authorities are using this as a pretext for suppressing public discourse on the violent and illegal behavior of Muslim gangs. Could it be that these judges believe that the gangs are providing a useful service? Norton and Marson certainly aren't oblivious to the realities facing commoners immersed in the budding UK utopia. Judge Norton seemed to have knives and death on her mind and yet said, "So what?" in response to the fate that might await Robinson in prison. Would it be, well, you know, don't steady on, Robert. Here's the problem. I think at a subliminal level, most of the establishment in the United Kingdom and in Europe understand that they have wrecked their nations, that there is no happy ending to the forces they have set in motion. I actually think at a certain level, even if they don't express it, even if they don't discuss it, but somewhere deep within, they understand that. Now, what do they do? All the people who insist that admitting large, admitting in effect Islam to nest in the heart of Christendom has no implications. All it means is that the unneeded Christian churches will become mosques, and the pubs will close or have to become coffee houses because Muslims don't drink. But otherwise, life will go on unchanged. I think they know in their heart of hearts that isn't true. And I think they also know, if you look at, for example, the part of Manchester where the guy who blew up the Ariana Grande concert came from, it used to be English. And then it became multicultural. And then it became Muslim. Because once a neighborhood becomes predominantly Muslim, it's not so comfortable to live in if you happen to be gay or Jewish or you're just a single woman who likes to have a drink with her friends and walk home alone late at night. So it's gone from uniculturally English to multicultural to uniculturally Muslim. And I think at a certain level, these guys understand that. But they cannot admit they're wrong. They were wrong. They cannot admit that what was done to Britain and to Europe and to other Western nations was actually imprudent and, in some respects, is an existential threat. And they cannot even admit that certain public policy changes, such as restraints on immigration, for example, might be made, or changes in immigration policy. They can't admit that. And that's why it's necessary. And as I said, at a certain level, I don't think this or that police chief or judge or social worker or member of parliament, I don't think they necessarily sit around and discuss all this stuff. But I think they have internalized the reality to the point where this cannot be discussed. And the most significant fact about what happened to Tommy Robinson seems to me this, and this is what Douglas Murray brought up when we were in Copenhagen. He mentioned Tommy Robinson, when I say he was savagely attacked in jail, you may be wondering what was he in jail for. He was in jail because he apparently made misrepresentations on a mortgage application. Now, there's people who do that, presumably they can get into trouble for it. But the British state basically used it as a pretext to jail Tommy Robinson, and then he got savagely attacked when he was in there. And Douglas just made the point, you know, well, there's all kinds of people who misrepresent themselves on mortgage applications. Why is it so important to get this guy in jail? And you contrast the fervor and the vigor with which they hunt down Tommy Robinson with the cold-hearted indifference to the victims of these these so-called grooming gang scandals. I don't like the word grooming because grooming makes it sound as if it's a thing other than what it is, which is industrial scale child rape, child gang rape, sex slavery. I went to Rotherham. I met these girls, some of whom now are damaged young women of 28, 30 up at the other end. I sat and I talked with them for hours and hours on end, and I was struck the stories they have to tell, for example, which are mostly about police indifference, which are mostly about calling the police, and then the police do nothing about the guy who's raping you, but they punish you. They tell you that you deserved it. You're dangled off a balcony. It's your fault for being a packy shagger. They douse you in petrol and dance around you with lit matches. It's your fault for being a packy shagger. They tell you it's your fault because you want to raise the child away from the rapists, and they won't let you. The horror stories these girls have to tell are amazing. And most of these stories have not been told in the British press. It's remarkable how few people, how few British journalists have taken the trouble to go and talk to these girls. That's the first thing. The second thing is that it's still going on. Katie, one of the young women I spoke to, was telling me that when she drops off her own daughter in Rotherham, she still sees the guys cruising, the middle-aged Muslim men cruising in their cars, in their fancy Audis and all the rest. And then 15 minutes later, she'll see them going round again, and there'll be a little pale, pasty, one-faced white girl of about 12 or 14 sitting in the seat. Rotherham still going on. Members of the South Yorkshire Police are also engaged in statutory rape with those girls. Members of the council also engaged in statutory rape of those girls. Thousands and thousands. The official number, I think, was 1,400. My sense of Rotherham actually is that that's an underestimate. Then it's going on in Telford, in Shropshire, and it's going on in Oxford, and it's going on in Yorkshire and Lancashire and all over the map. And there's no outrage. And the judges who profess to be outraged because supposedly Tommy Robinson says Muslim paedophiles, Muslim child rapists, and he forgets to say alleged Muslim paedophiles and alleged Muslim child rapists. If there was 1/100th of the outrage that Judge Norton and Judge Marson profess to feel because Tommy Robinson leaves out the word alleged, if there was 1/100th of the outrage that the British state felt toward Tommy Robinson, if 1/100th of that outrage were to be transferred to these guys who rape and take children as their sex slaves for years on end, it would not be happening. But in essence, these girls have been sacrificed on the altar of diversity, and nobody cares about them. Nobody cares about them. Tom Brook writes, Mark, I probably won't make the Q&A this afternoon, but I do have a question. Do you think the American left's attitude toward Islam would be any different if a Democrat had been in charge on 9/11? Another way to ask is how much of the left's attitude towards Islam is reactionary against the, quote, conservative George Bush? I think that's a part of it, Tom. My view is, though, if there had been, you know, if you take the way the Democrats reacted to 9/11, people like Hillary Clinton at the time were gung-ho to stick it to Iraq and bomb Afghanistan and all the rest of it. And they only began to climb off of that once it became clear, once the broader Democrat base started souring on the war. But I think initially, I think that would always have happened. And I think that would always have happened. Because I think basically, you know, war presupposes that you have enemies who wish you ill. And I think that is so alien to the leftist mindset now. And I think, again, even if you go back and you recall those first days after 9/11, by which I mean the first week, it's actually in my book, The Face of the Tiger. It's a Face of the Tiger may not have much to recommend it, but it does accurately, I think, can capture the mood of those first days and weeks after 9/11. And already the root causes, the poverty breeds resentment, the total failure, the inability, which is the great paradox of multiculturalism and diversity, the ability to imagine, for all your blather about multiculturalism and diversity, that there's anyone on the planet who doesn't think like you. You know, so the idea that these guys in Afghanistan, you know, if you just had some job training programs, if you had a few more internships in Kandahar or Jalalabad, then they wouldn't want to become jihad. You know, the economic reductivism of the left, I think all that would still be going on. Anula writes, Dear M. Stein, don't know whether that means dear Mark Stein or dear Monsieur Stein. I hope it's Monsieur. Dear Monsieur Stein, congratulations on your outstanding victory in the courts. Justice feels so good. I find your site so absolutely refreshing under the circumstances. Mainstream media has lost so much credibility that the Tommy Robinson petition on change.org has almost 500,000 signatures. Only sleepwalkers will believe the slander labelling him as far right, along with concerned football lads and freedom-loving, law-abiding citizens who still have the will to protest and speak up against ever-growing tyranny and divisive tactics of domination. I hope that all the silenced voices, for fear of reprisals in several EU countries, will find this petition too, because I'm sure they would like to sign without losing their job. Anula, I think I mentioned that I met Tommy Robinson at the European Parliament. He's intelligent, he's engaging, he's charismatic. You run up in Britain, you run up against the kind of snob factor because he's a street guy. And the respectable classes dislike that about him. If you actually watch him, I think I put in a link to his interview with Jeremy Paxman, who used to be the most fearsome BBC interviewer on Newsnight. He was someone who could fillet people. That's what he was. And he's grown a little sort of sleepy over the years, but he was super sleepy with Tommy Robinson. And I think Tommy Robinson, to anyone who's followed issues of Islam and the West, Tommy Robinson was informed and Jeremy Paxman was out of his depth. But I invite you to look that up on the internet and reach your own conclusions about that. I would simply say, and we have club members who object, who don't like Tommy Robinson. You know, and like I'm like an effete show tune queen. Obviously, if I ran into Tommy Robinson in a pub in Luton, he'd think I was just some sissy show tune boy and wouldn't want anything to do with me. That's fair enough. I understand social distaste, but I reiterate a point that I've made for over a decade now, that if the respectable parties, if all the respectable people in society rule certain subjects out of bounds, then people will turn to the unrespectable ones. That's not a great insight of mine. It's perfectly bloody obvious. Or it should be. To the British and European political consensus, and to a certain extent in the United States, because it explained what happened with Trump. Basically, the Democrats. Basically, there are two parties. It's a two-party system, and both parties decided they didn't want to talk about immigration. The Democrats, because they want new voters. And the Republicans, because they want cheap labor. The Democrats' position is shrewd and logical from their point of view. The Republican one is completely stupid, which is why they're called the stupid party. But the fact of the matter is that the people wanted the right to talk about immigration. And so when immigration, so they can't talk to the Democrats about it. Republicans are all open borders fanatics like Lindsey Graham and Paul Ryan. And you have people like Marco Rubio and Jeb Bush saying illegal immigration is an act of love and all the rest of it. And so eventually a significant number of people said, to hell with both parties, we'll go for this guy, Trump. And Trump basically performed a hostile takeover of the Republican Party, which is where we are to now. Now, that's exactly the same thing that has happened in the United Kingdom, in France, in Germany, in the Netherlands, in Scandinavia, in Italy, and in Eastern Europe, where people have, where the respectable classes have said, I'm sorry, but you just can't talk about immigration. It's vulgar and racist, so please don't talk about it. You can talk about, we've got a narrow range of political subjects that we think are fascinating to talk about, and that's all we're going to talk about. So if you want to talk about immigration, you can't because it's racist. So to hell with you. And at a certain point, people say, well, we're not going to be told which issues we can and can't talk about. So if people, and I understand there's a club member who makes very shrewd and perceptive comments, and he correctly makes the observation, I think, that the far right is likely to increase in popularity in part because the soggy centre in British and European politics has now got so soggy that all you're going to do is just sink in it. What's interesting about the Tommy Robinson case is that it's happening under a so-called conservative government. We have a so-called conservative government that would be unrecognizable to virtually any member of Mrs. Thatcher's cabinet from the 80s. In 1979, when Mrs. Thatcher's Conservative Party won the election, they talked quite openly and honestly about immigration. They talked about it in terms of numbers. They didn't sentimentalize the issue. They didn't sugarcoat the issue. They talked about it in a businesslike way in numbers terms. And that would be unrecognizable to someone like Theresa May or almost anyone who matters in her cabinet. And that is why when you have a conservative party that doesn't want to conserve anything, that is now actually talking about banning fireplaces in country homes, that's how conservative the Conservative Party of the United Kingdom are, people will turn to unrespectable forces. Owen Morgan writes, it seems that the Italian electorate is being told to rerun the recent general election because the voters got the answer wrong last time. Pressure from the EU and Germany is blamed. Is there a pattern here? Yes, indeed. As you know, it's somehow a populist, so-called populist government emerged from the usual Italian electoral chaos. And it's interesting because this isn't like those Eastern European countries which have just emerged from the Warsaw Pact. This is one of the founding nations of the EU. This is one of the original six members. What was the original six members? Belgium, Netherlands, Luxembourg, France, Germany, and Italy. So this is part of the hardcore of European Union. And they got the answer wrong, and they're now being told you can keep voting until you get the answer right, which is the way they do it. Maggie Menzies writes, it seems that nowadays no dissension of any nature is to be brooked by our progressive overlords. Trump supporters were deplorables. Tommy Robinson is treated as a perpetual enemy of the state. People lose their livelihoods because of their opinions, to say nothing of climate change. What can and should we do about it? Almost all of this, and I bring it back to the Irish abortion referendum, comes when you agree to discuss everything within the shrunken parameters of the left. They want to say, you can't talk about this because it's racist. You can't talk about that because it's sexist. You can't talk about that because you're a climate denialist. You know, they just want to, they want the labels to, they don't want to hold the debate. They want to close the debate down. And that's why free speech is always, whenever anyone's telling you you can't say that, you should reject that argument. You should say, no, I'm going to say it. And then if you've got a problem with it, you can explain why I'm wrong. But the more you imprison the boundaries of debate in this box, and the box is getting narrower and narrower, the more you do that, the more you basically hand the left their victory. Because that's the one thing, actually, that the left and Islam have in common, that they think huge sections of life are beyond debate. Islam basically says, you can't talk about this, you can't talk about that, and all the rest of it. And the left is like that too. And interestingly, when you look at the sort of lack of curiosity that's present on many university campuses now, the way people are content to be told, well, this is the line on Islam, this is the line on transgender rights, this is, you don't have to think about these things. Eventually, what's striking to me is it takes on the Dar al-Islam is like a kind of contemporary college campus. And a contemporary college campus is like the Dar al-Islam. The essential ingredient there is the lack of curiosity, the lack of curiosity that prompts you to intellectual inquiry, the lack of curiosity that the lack of curiosity and intellectual inquiry. Intellectual inquiry and curiosity are essential to great achievements in science, great achievements in the arts, and great achievements in human progress and liberty. And that's why Islam's contributions to science and the arts these last 1,300 years have been more or less irrelevant. While and that is that same kind of lack of curiosity and indifference to inquiry that you see at the contemporary college campus is very telling. Mark Ferrigno writes, Mark, watching Tommy Robinson being disappeared by the British establishment is truly terrifying. Does this show Muslim rape gangs are a permanent feature of life in the UK? Also, am I paranoid in thinking the British establishment, figuring to actually kill Tommy, is hoping that 13 months in maximum security prison is enough time for the problem to take care of itself via Muslim prison gangs? Yeah, are Muslim rape gangs a permanent feature of life in the UK? That's interesting to me. Rotherham was a public scandal. Outside the United Kingdom, the only thing anybody knows about Rotherham is that that's where children get raped and were raped and raped and raped for years and years and years on end, while the social workers and the police and the politicians did nothing about it. And as I said, I saw with my own eyes the evidence that the abduction of young girls is still going on in Rotherham. The sex gangs are still happening in Rotherham. Now, that's in a town that has come under immense scrutiny for, and was an people, you know, they did what they usually did. They had an inquiry, and there were like brave female MPs who came and spoke about it, and the brave female MP, I think one of them got an MBE or an OBE, that's a member or officer of the Order of the British Empire. And so they did. The British establishment did what it usually did. It had a little moment in the spotlight. It handed out some gongs, and then everybody's, you know, they can't get the girls I spoke to can't get the attention of the politicians now, because they were invited to Downing Street. A couple of them went to Downing Street once, and they met David Cameron. And he checked that off his list. You know, he's done Rotherham. And that's how they feel. That's how they feel about it. So, yes, it is going on still, and it's not going to change. And that's actually, that's amazing to me that they basically feel that they know this is going on, but addressing it honestly is too difficult for them. Kate Smith, or Smythe, says, "Hi, Mark. Regarding non-Russians in the Russia investigation, how many degrees of separation are there between Alexander 007 Downer and Stefan Halper? Are they directly connected, as the title of your recent article suggests? Do you personally expect to be banned from speaking in the UK or have online content blocked at some point in the future based on recent events there, including the Tommy Robinson case?" Well, what was astonishing to me is the number of people that they've banned from the UK who land at Heathrow and are turned back. I find that really disturbing. I find it particularly disturbing when they are subjects of the Crown, such as happened to Lauren Southern, because I'm old-fashioned enough to believe that the Queen's subjects should be able to move between her realms at ease. And I think it would be, and I don't rule out that at some point they will find it easier just to exclude larger and larger numbers of people from the United Kingdom. Now, I don't mean, everyone thinks this is very cute. I saw somebody, you know, Hugo Rifkin, who wrote a column in the Times about how the American image of the United Kingdom as a sort of hollowed out. I joked some years ago that Britain was turning into Somalia with chip shops. And yes, it has an element of exaggeration, but that is the trend line. And actually, the chip shops are disappearing. You know, if you go through the East End, it's actually getting very hard to find fish and chips in the East End. I was exaggerating, but the trend line is there. And Hugo Rifkin and other, and the Guido Fawkes, the big blogger, were mocking this. They're mocking this. And Guido Fawkes said, yes, you know, life in Britain is hellish. Someone gave me an odd look on Southern Railways the other day. And what he means, of course, by that is that for many people, life in Britain is still very agreeable. If you have a country home in one of those Wiltshire villages, if somewhere in the Cotswolds, and you go down to your country cottage every weekend, and you look out from the back of your cottage at the fields going toward the ha-ha. Do you have a ha-ha? I haven't said ha-ha in a long time. It's an English landscaping device. It's like a large ditch that they used to put at the end of the garden, separating the garden from the fields beyond, so you didn't have to look at a big hedgerow. So you could come out and sit on your terrace, have Pimm's on your terrace, look at your lawn stretching to the ha-ha, and then the great ancient hedgerows and fields beyond stretching into the distance. And you had like a beautiful, and if you've got some like spectacular £2 million weekend home in Wiltshire, you think that England, undying England, is a terribly agreeable and civilized place to live, and that all these people get it. Why does Tommy Robinson have to spoil it by getting so excited about all these Muslim chappies? Well, you've met a couple of these Muslim chappies. They seem perfectly enough. Yeah. That's the isolation that comes. Hugo Rifkin, who wrote this column in the Times, is the son of Sir Malcolm Rifkin, the former Her Britannic Majesty's former Secretary of State for Foreign Affairs. So, you know, yes, if you're Hugo Rifkin, life goes on and seems very agreeable for all kinds of people. Jeremy Paxman at the BBC, life is incredibly agreeable. If you live in the East End of London, if you live in Luton, if you live in Bradford, Yorkshire, if you live in large parts of Birmingham in the English Midlands, you understand that what is happening is transformative because your part of England has already been transformed. So it's just a question of how much more gets transformed and what England is looking like at the end point of that transformation. And maybe at that point, the guy sitting there in his beautiful country home in the Cotswolds, sitting on the terrace, looking out at the lawns stretching to the ha-ha, and then the ancient fields beyond, he might actually at that point be able to discern a couple of fire-breathing imams on the far horizon. But right now he can't, so he thinks this kind of talk is nutty, which is, again, one more reason why it gets left to the likes of Tommy Robinson. Rich writes, "Hello, Mark. Love the club. Quick question today. Have you followed the news regarding the Italian government? My understanding is the Italians have a dual executive system. The far-right populist parties, the League and Five Star." Five Star was my favourite boy band in the 90s. Oh, no, wait, that's... never mind. Five Star won big 3 months ago. "And the current president does not want to seat the incoming finance minister as he's anti-EU. No government in 80-plus days. The Italian market has started to tank, and they're already at about 130% debt to GDP. It seems like Italy, as Nigel Farage pointed out with respect to Greece a few years back, is an economic Volkerkerker. The opportunities to use that word are few and far between, so I had to get that one in there. What say you? In a few years, we will be discussing Italy-ve the way we talk about Brexit, or will the EU be able to fight off and ignore the wishes of Italian voters? Thank you." Well, thank you for saying Volkerkerker. That basically means, a kind of society that's imprisoned by its own regulations, or its own rules, as it were, that if you look at what's happening... that it's in a trap created, that in a sense its own structures become a trap for it. And I think that is true in the case of Italy. In this instance, you mentioned the president. Since they abolished the House of Savoy after the Second World War, the Italian president has rather more powers, particularly in these circumstances, than, say, a non-executive president in Germany would have. But I don't know. I don't think this is going away. So I think there's no doubt that both the European Union and the establishments of all these countries are doing their best to squash the populist urges of their electorates, and they have had some success with it. They, in a sense, they sort of ran Macron as a kind of ersatz populist against Madame Le Pen in France, and it worked. And that's actually more cunning than what they try to do in most cases, which is as we talked about earlier, you know, just rerun the election again or whatever. But in the end, all they can do is suppress it. They can try to hold the lid on, and they can hold the lid on for another 6 months or another year or another 2 years. But this isn't going anywhere good for these guys. The answer is, if you don't like some of these people that are winning elections, the answer is, to go back to my line about how if the respectable parties are forbidden from talking about certain subjects, unrespectable parties will rise, come along, and start talking about them. The real position is to tolerate a higher level of engagement and public discourse by the establishments. T.F. Boggs writes, "Is there an Orwell out there to write the updated Animal Farm set on a quiet street in Rotherham in 2015? Would it matter? What was the impact of Animal Farm when it was first published? And where the hell is the British resistance to all this madness? Was it just Robinson?" You know, this we talk about this popular resistance. My worry is this, that most people are it is in the nature, it is in human nature that most people are followers. Most people are followers. And most people want to be on the side that most people are on. That's a basic rule of life. That's why when you walk into Barnes & Noble, the first table is the 10 best-selling books. So you can read what everybody else is reading. That's why on Monday morning on the Today Show, they tell you the movie grosses for the weekend. So you can go and watch what everybody else is watching. Because that answers actually a deep urge within people. Most people want to be on the side that most people are on. So a mass movement, there is a window of opportunity for a mass movement. And then at a certain point, stuff is so wrecked that the side that most people are on is the side of quiet life, appeasement, all the rest of it. Somebody reminded me in our comment section earlier today of the scene that I dislike the most in the Churchill movie, Darkest Hour, where Churchill supposedly gets on the London Tube. I don't believe that ever happened. I think he went on the Tube once. I believe it was during the general strike in 1926, Winston Churchill went on the Tube. But it shows him going on the Tube, on the London Underground, and he, at the lowest point, just when Lord Halifax is saying, Britain has to reach a deal with Germany, has to come to terms with Germany, has to sue. We can't win. We got to see what kind of deal we can get with Germany. And Churchill's very depressed, and he goes on the London Tube, and he's bucked up by the spirits of the English people. And the truth is, no, that's not what happened. Chamberlain and appeasement was very popular. And it wasn't that Churchill was bucked up by the plucky, never-say-die spirits of the British people. It's that he had to buck them up, and he had to drag them over towards his position of defiance. When he was doing all that, we shall fight on the beaches stuff, they were, well, I don't know about that. I don't know, you know. And so this idea that there is an innate, inherent sort of great popular resentment that is boiling, I don't think is true. As I said, most people want to be on the side that most people are on. And as we see in Ireland, and as we see in Britain, and as we see in Europe, if you're continually told by the likes of the BBC that only unreasonable people get annoyed by Muslim rape gangs, you think, well, I think of myself as a nice, reasonable person. So if I'm a nice, reasonable person, then it's appropriate to get annoyed by sexual assault by a Radio 1 disc jockey in the green room before Top of the Pops in 1972. But it's not appropriate to get annoyed about mass sexual assault of children that's going on right now. And let's, what's the next question now? Hi, Mark. This morning on Morning Joe, Charles Moritz, or Moritz, I don't know whether you say, do you say like Sam Moritz or Moritz? However it is, Charles, we're grateful for your question. Hi, Mark. This morning, I might pronounce all the names of our club members in the French style from now on. Hi, Mark. This morning on Morning Joe. That was your first mistake, Charles. What the hell were you doing watching that show? Hi, Mark. This morning on Morning Joe, James Clapper was asked to define the difference between a spy and an informant. Mr. Clapper's lips moved and sound came forth, but I'll be damned if it made any sense, with hopes and confidence that you can do a better job. Thanks, Charlie. Oh, by the way, that reminds me. I forgot about the Alexander Downer Stefan Halper thing. which I was asked about by Kate earlier. So let me combine those. Yeah, Mr. Clapper is in the spy business. So when he's like trying to come up with it, people think spies are. I was joking, as Kate mentioned, about Alexander Downer being like 007, rappelling down the walls of the presidential palace in the dead of night, like some black garb ninja. That's not actually what spies do. Spies, there's a very small element of that. Most of the time when you're working as a spy, you're dressed in ordinary clothes and you're doing fairly ordinary things. You're particularly spending a lot of time waiting. That's a lot of what it is. And James Clapper knows this. He's in the spy business and he understands that, you know, spy is a faintly ludicrous word because of what we see in things like James Bond. But there is, to me, what's interesting is what I would call the sort of vast freelance community. And that's where this Stefan Halper comes in. He's very typical of a lot of people. This is a guy whose connections with the CIA go back to when George H.W. Bush ran the CIA in the 70s. He was a campaign volunteer for Bush Sr. in 1980. He goes back a long way with the CIA. Now, he's not a CIA, quote, agent, unquote, but he's someone who is useful to U.S. intelligence and British intelligence. And he's available for work on their behalf. And he has a persuasive cover in that he's a professor at Cambridge, which is a very undemanding job. So it gives you lots of time. So he's the kind of guy you can say to, we have a little bit of a problem. We've got a little bit of a problem in Warsaw. Do you think you could just take the train up to Heathrow, hop on a flight to Warsaw? We'd like you to meet with somebody, just have lunch with him, and let us know what comes of that. That's what a guy like Halper does. And that freelance community of people who have decades-old ties to the CIA or to MI6 is actually quite large. Now, when I did the timeline on what Alexander Downer was doing with this guy, this fellow Papadopoulos, when he met with him at the Kensington Wine Rooms, which are nowhere near Australia House. So this is a nobody, this guy. He's nobody, except he happens to be a Trump campaign volunteer and he's young and impressionable. They know he's young and impressionable because they've already fed him certain things and they've gotten him to agree to certain things. So why Mr. Downer's assistant at Australia House would call up this guy and says that the Australian High Commissioner wants to meet you and have a drink with you? Why? Why, if he did want to meet him, why didn't he say, come round at 10:30, 10:45, to Australia House in whatever it is, just off the Strand, the Aldwych. Aldwych, is that what it's called? I don't go to London as often as he used to. Just off the Strand, Australia House. Why don't you come round and... No, because that way he has to be checked in, he's in the records. So no, he meets him at the Kensington Wine Rooms, just round the corner from Stoke Lodge in Hyde Park, which is the Australian High Commissioner's residence. If you're telling me that that's actually a straight-up encounter, I'm sorry, I don't believe it. I don't believe that for a moment. I think that's something that was arranged for a purpose, and I don't think Mr. Papadopoulos was aware of the purpose. Michelle Dulac says, a question on the helper thing, Mark. Adam Schiff was on one of the Sunday morning talk shows, and he said, one, Trump has made all sorts of claims about his campaign, as that Trump Tower was wiretapped, that Pfizer applications were mishandled, and now this FBI spy was insinuated in the campaign before there even was a Russia investigation. All of this is untrue, he said, and then literally in the next sentence, he said, all of this was stunningly common FBI practice. Which is it? You're absolutely right, Michelle. That's basically this argument. None of this happened, and if it did, it's just standard operating procedure. That's what you're being told that's what you're being told by these people. Let's take one final question from Raj, who's writing to us from Ontario. That's the Ontario in the Dominion of Canada, not the Ontario in California. And or the Ontario County, New York, which is somewhere. Where's that? In the Finger Lakes? I can't remember. I drove through it once, I think. Hi, Mark. The instrumental score at the top of your show reminds me of one of those British telly sleuth shows. What kind of sleuth are you? One like the quintessential Brit Sherlock Holmes or the Belgian Hercule Poirot? I'm not alluding to your Belgian-British ancestry. Neither am I stalking you. I don't actually have any. I don't know. I was going to say I don't have any British ancestry unless you include Irish with the English, Scots, and Welsh. Because on my paternal grandmother was Irish Catholic. So if you consider that British, I am. But I don't know. I think you're alluding to, in fact, we've got a little kind of spy arrangement of our Nine Lives theme that we run, I think, 5 or 6 minutes before we actually start this show. And I only did that. Kevin Amos, who's our great musical director, we only put that together because I love John Barry's music. And John Barry did the Bond films for basically the first 20 years. I think the last one he did was The Living Daylights. First 25 years. And he basically invented spy music. You know, there's very few people who invent a form of music. There's very few people who can say, I invented the concerto, or I invented the symphony, or I invented the opera. But John Barry actually invented single-handedly spy music, which is amazing. That's an amazing thing to do. That's an amazing accomplishment. He's the first and greatest spy composer. And I don't really think I'm quite as brainy to be Sherlock Holmes or Hercule Poirot, Raj, but I do. I have a certain sentimental affection for old kinds of private investigator type shows. And speaking of John Barry, he's got a thing. It's not a harpsichord. It's something like a jangly thing like that in his terrific theme to The Persuaders with Roger Moore and Tony Curtis. And I loved that show. Roger Moore was supposedly the son of an earl, and Tony Curtis is a tough Brooklyn streetwise guy, and they team up to solve capers in the south of France and all the rest of it. And it's got the fantastic opening titles where the girl with the bikini walks in the opposite direction between them, and both the high-class, eyebrow-cocking, David Arnold put it on our John Barry tribute, the eyebrow-cocking Roger Moore turns round, and the streetwise Brooklyn punk Tony Curtis, they both turn round and look at the rear end of the dolly bird in the bikini as it recedes into the horizon. So if I were going to be one of those people who solves mysteries, I think I would like to be with the rather unlikely partner of Roger Moore and Tony Curtis in The Persuaders. But check that out, Raj, because that is one of the great television themes of all time. We've overrun our time a bit. It is now 10 p.m. in London and Dublin, and in Her Majesty's prison in Hull, where presumably the incarcerated Tommy Robinson has turned in for the night. Wherever you are around this planet, thank you for joining us. The way you get to be part of this, like Raj with his somewhat specific question, is to join the Mark Stein Club. We'd love to have you. We're having a cruise. We're going to be cruising this late September, early October. We're going to be cruising the St. Lawrence from Montreal and then down the eastern seaboard to Boston at the height of foliage season. And we will do some of the things we do at Stein Online live at sea. We'll do a couple of editions of the Mark Stein Show. We'll do one of our poems at Halifax, Nova Scotia or somewhere. And we'll do a tale for our time live somewhere along the way. So if you'd like to join the club, if you'd like to come on the cruise, go to steinonline.com and check us out, and we would love to have you. We will see you next time on Mark Stein's Clubland Q&A.